Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Candace Walsh and Laura Andre, who are co-editors of the new book, Dear John, I Love Jane. And we will be speaking to James McGrath Morris about the alternative gift market. I'd like now to welcome back to the program Marielle Nanasi. She is a senior policy analyst with New Energy Economy. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. Thanks again for having us.
So, a very big piece of news. We talked several months ago at length about the carbon cap rule, which was being considered by the Environmental Improvement Board, and the relative merits of having carbon caps on a state level, on a national level, and so on. This rule has passed the Environmental Improvement Board. So for environmentalists and many others, it's a very big day.
It's a really big day. It's been so exciting, not only for environmentalists, but I believe also for people who are concerned with our economy. We have been going down this fossil fuel production path for 200 years, basically. And it served us at one point. And now we have an opportunity at hand. And that opportunity is to transition into a new energy economy. New Mexico has a long history of being an energy-producing state. And now we need to truly take advantage of we're on the cusp to transition to and to diversify our energy production and to include renewables. And really, we could be at the cutting edge of technology that both reduces carbon pollution and creates jobs. And I think that's the moment we're at, and that's what this policy is the foundation for, and it's an exciting time.
And of course, you're called New Energy Economy and not New Green Earth or something like that. And this is all about creating jobs in a sunny, windy state that is ripe for solar and wind energy and has critical mass of scientists and technological know-how in the state.
That's exactly right. We believe that this policy foundation, combined with our really world-class solar and wind resources, puts New Mexico on course to compete in the clean energy market. And as I said before, I believe that this is a job creator, that this will trigger enormous investments in renewable energy. And yes, we have Sandia Labs in Los Alamos, and we have the second greatest solar resources in the country.
Now, what does the carbon cap rule that was just passed actually say?
It says that it will reduce carbon pollution emissions by 3% per year from 2010 levels, starting in 2013. And they will be reducing from the sources that emit more than 25,000 metric tons of carbon per year. And basically, this rule would address 65% of the current carbon pollution that causes global warming.
65% of New Mexico's contribution to global warming pollution. But it's still by some measurements, pretty small amount, by some measurements, pretty reasonable amount to be reducing. I mean, is it going to make a difference?
It's going to make a difference, and I'll tell you a couple of reasons why. Number one, this potentially catapults us into a leadership role. A lot of the states that have taken some action to reduce carbon emissions are not energy-producing states. So for us to take that leadership role as an energy producer, we are really making a greater transition and also a greater statement nationally and actually internationally to say, yes, we are going to produce energy, but we're going to produce it in a clean or low carbon way. In terms of the actual reductions, you know, we have a whole history in the United States of belief, our legal system has always really endorsed the premise that if there is harm and you are responsible, then you must take action to mitigate that harm. Because you can't deal with all the harm doesn't mean you shouldn't start. And I actually think that this will put us, again, in a position where we will attract investment and attract business, so that we could actually, the same technologies that address this question could not only cause jobs at home, but we could be seen as a leader. People will come to us to say, how can we address this problem? It's a worldwide problem that we need to fix.
There's two pieces to it. One is that having a carbon cap actually reduces, to some extent, CO2 pollution. The other is that it attracts investment to the state, where if you don't have carbon caps and you've got free rein for fossil fuel production, they're not as likely to move here. How does that actually work?
Well, one of the very interesting things is that there was a group of investors who gathered in New York earlier this year, and they said, we need one thing to create an economically stable environment in which for us to invest, and that is a cap on carbon pollution. And they said, if you give us that assurance that our investment basically will make good, will be okay, will be protected, then we're likely to come. The other thing is let's just put it into perspective about fossil fuel production. Very little has changed in coal. We're using 60-year-old or older technology. And there are all these opportunities out there. There's all this solar, all these different kinds of solar apparatuses able right now, decentralized solar and centralized solar, to produce energy. And if, PNM, frankly, has created this coal-fired production that has externalized all the costs. Who's paying those costs? The people are paying those costs.
Now, what we're talking about is, okay, the cost of greenhouse gases, but also the cost of mercury in the streams that kill the fish and that kill people and that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Last year alone, the PNM was cited with 60,000 air quality violations. 60,000 air quality violations for which they had to pay a fine. And we're talking about spewing pollution into the air, which is causing asthma problems and hospitalizations. Just in the last 10 years, the asthma rate in New Mexico has increased 16%. Who's paying for that? We all are paying for that in higher hospitalization costs and emergency room visits, etc. And then there's other problems. I mean, you go up to the Farmington area and you see the San Juan River. There's signs there that says, beware, do not eat the fish in here. There's so much mercury poisoning. And there are no boundaries, and that the air pollution and the carbon is coming down to Santa Fe and
right.
Albuquerque and the South.
Because of the weather.
Exactly.
We're talking to Mariel Nanasi of New Energy Economy. Green jobs, are they real? Are they a reality yet?
I think that they're not only a reality. We can look specifically, let's look at California as an example. It's the place where they have had the most stringent carbon cap, and now we're joining them, and we're in the same league as California with a new cap on carbon pollution. And they have attracted billions of dollars worth of investment. They have created thousands, tens of thousands of jobs in the green industries. And it's the reason why AB 32, which is the Global Warming Solutions Act that was passed there, survived. There was an attack on the Global Warming Solutions Act, which is AB 32, by oil and coal, and it was soundly defeated. And why is because it was the safest, the strongest, stable part of the California economy. As a matter of fact, it's the only part of the economy that was booming and creating jobs. I'm just looking at a brand new study that came out from the Solar Foundation. Last year, they added 93,000 jobs, and they believe that they are going to create, they will have, I'll read to you exactly.
93 in solar and wind?
It's in solar alone.
In solar alone.
And they said over the next 12 months, over 50% of solar firms expect to add jobs, and that they're going to, they say, by next year, they will add 26% more jobs than they currently added this year. And that's important, but it's especially important when compared to what the U.S. as a whole seeks to add, which is only 2%.
Are we in New Mexico ready for this kind of investment? Do we have the workforce?
Well, that's also kind of interesting. There's been a real boon in all the community colleges, whether it's in Santa Fe or it's in Tucumcari or actually in San Juan County. There is, it's the one area of all those schools that has the most student interest. There's actually a waiting list in some of the schools, and that runs the gamut from energy efficiency work to wind turbine manufacturing to solar installation, and so that's also really exciting. And I think that we're a bit late, frankly, but we are catching up quickly, and so that's really encouraging. Luna Community College, it has a big solar waiting list already.
Yeah.
So it's pretty neat.
So basically, students. They know perfectly well what the future holds, and
they're excited to be part of this this transition. I mean, you talk to the youth, and they want to be part of a new energy economy. They said, "We want those green jobs."
Right. How has the Martinez transition team, Susana Martinez, our next governor, responded to this? If they have,
well, you know, she ran on a platform of "We need to bring jobs to New Mexico." And frankly, if you look at her progressive Republican gubernatorial colleagues, whether it's Schwarzenegger, who was obviously on his way out, but clearly was out front about understanding that reducing pollution was also, carbon pollution was also a job creator. And now you look at Michael Bloomberg, who is one of the leaders in the world, who said, "I'm going to tackle this problem, and it's going to be a job creator in the meantime." So we're hoping that she'll really look at the facts that this transition to a clean energy economy will actually be a magnet for job creation in the state.
That's your hopeful thinking. But has she said anything?
Well, to date, she hasn't endorsed the. As a matter of fact, she's come out against. She's vowed to come out against both our rule and the rule that was that NMED passed, the cap and trade rule. But we're hopeful.
New Mexico Environment Department.
Yeah, thank you, sorry. But we're hopeful that, you know, she's going to be thoughtful about this, and if she has her economic development team review this situation, she might take a stance that welcomes this, actually. I mean, she was talking about Walmart in her campaign, and Walmart has really taken, I know that there's some problems that they're facing right now about a discrimination lawsuit, but in terms of climate, they are taking a rather progressive stance. I mean, they're looking to transition their entire, not only transportation fleet, but all their stores to make them completely renewable. And so
I've often hoped that Walmart, just Walmart or Target or both, would put those solar panels over their parking lots that would power not only the store but the whole neighborhood and provide shade for the cars underneath right. it and so on.
We know that they have a lot of roof space. So
they have a lot of parking lot space.
They have a lot of parking lot and roof space. So we'd like them to use it for the good of communities all around.
One thing I think is important to mention very briefly is one of the arguments against solar energy is that it's not competitive with coal. There are so many people, as we speak, working very hard on new solar technologies. I know some of them personally, and in conversation with people about this, that are, in fact, just poised to compete with coal, in which case it's kind of game over pretty soon.
Exactly. And, you know, frankly, there's if we just take away the subsidies from coal, oil, and gas, we could repower the entire nation with solar. With renewable energy.
Solar and others.
Solar, wind, and others. Yes, exactly. You know, it's quite interesting. You don't hear too many businesses opposing us. You only hear, like, PNM and the old fossil fuel
production. Fossil fuel producers.
You know?
Are they, I mean, if I were they, I would kind of be getting into this market myself.
I know. And it's interesting. I mean, PNM just spent $330 million throwing good money after bad, which is all of our money. I mean, that's how they get that money is
right.
From
our bills that
our
we
bills.
Pay
to clean up pollution problems at San Juan Generating Facility. And guess what? They're in for a whole nother hundreds of millions of dollars more that they're going to have to pay to keep that open. California was a part owner of San Juan, and they've said, we're out of here. We're no longer going to buy any more coal production. As of 2016, which is just around the corner, they said, we don't want any more part of San Juan Generating Facility. So PNM has made bad decisions. They have run this company, pretty incompetently, frankly, and have really failed to see to take action in this transition. And
they also spent a lot of money opposing the carbon cap, which just passed.
Yeah. Their lawyers are driving new cars.
We're talking to Marielle Nanasi. She's a senior policy analyst with New Energy Economy. And the carbon cap rule for New Mexico has just been passed by the Environmental Improvement Board. And this has gotten quite a lot of press all over the United States, not just here in New Mexico.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting to see it in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, the LA Times, and, of course, Santa Fe, New Mexican. And being with you, Mary Charlotte, KSFR has been just...
the non-national press.
The non-national press, the local press who really endorses all sort of community development, and that's what I think that this is ultimately about, is that we believe that this policy, combined with our renewable resources, will really change the face of New Mexico and give us a chance to compete in a global energy market. It's the largest market in the world, and if we take advantage of this opportunity, I think that will create jobs and create a healthier economy in New Mexico.
And maybe not be 49th
in everything. I know.
In every third
thing. I know. That would be really lovely.
Marielle Nanasi from New Energy Economy, newenergyeconomy.org. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome Candace Walsh and Laura Andre. They are co-editors of the new book, Dear John, I Love Jane, Women Write About Leaving Men for Women, published by Seal Press. And tomorrow night, they'll be at Collected Works Bookstore, Thursday the 9th of December at 6 o'clock in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this book was motivated, among other things, by your own story, Candace.
Yes, it was. I was at a point in my life where my marriage was over, and I had always had a certain curiosity about pursuing a relationship with a woman. Nothing really had ever lined up for me in the past. When I was in my early 20s, I was pretty shy, and I was much more comfortable being hit on than being somebody who would approach women. And as anyone who's been in a same-sex flirting zone can attest to, it's much more oblique, and I just never could quite connect with a person of the same sex. And of course, there's all the little, you know, elements that have to do with whether you're even attracted to certain people. And the norm was to be in a situation where there were men and women around, milling around, hitting on each other. And that was something that I just kind of went with for a long time.
And then a moment came where it was basically for you, as it is for many of the people who write in this anthology, a kind of a coming out story.
Yes, I was 35. I believe the term for coming out later is that you're a late BN. And So I really felt like, you know, once I did get married, I was married for about 7 years, and I pretty much figured that was that. I wasn't going to be pursuing that particular path of being with women because I had made a commitment that I thought was going to last for the rest of my life. And so it was once the marriage did end, I was very kind of excited amidst all the pain and anguish that comes with a divorce. And there was a little bit of excitement for me because here was my opportunity. Here we were in Santa Fe, lots of gay people. At the time, there wasn't a gay bar, but I could check it out. I didn't want to passively get involved with another man and still continue to wonder about this. I was ready to just put myself out there, even if it was terribly uncomfortable, really awkward, and felt like being back in junior high.
And you wasted no time, and here you are with your partner, Laura, and the two of you, well, you've edited a number of books, anthologies, and now here's this new book, Dear John, I Love Jane. And one of the things that's very interesting about it is this question of whether people really change or whether they go in an honest manner to the way they really always have been.
Yeah, that's an important fine line that many women struggled with, and we found that the writers in the book also struggled with that, you know, how to define themselves. Are they bona fide lesbians all along who just kind of clued in rather late in life or relatively later? Or is this something that actually shifted on them, you know, against their will in some cases? And I think we see both of that in the book. There's one of the contributors, Amelia Souter, who lives up in Ithaca, wrote very, very succinctly that you won't find myself rewriting history to say I was gay all along. I was straight. Now I'm gay. And, you know,
that's kind of unusual, though, isn't it?
I think it depends. Some of the research that has been done on sexual fluidity, mostly by Lisa Diamond, who wrote the preface or the foreword for the book, she found a number of subjects that it sort of happened in this cataclysmic way, who, you know, really fully and happily embraced heterosexuality and suddenly woke up one day finding themselves like head over heels in love with another woman. You know, it doesn't necessarily happen in one day, but in terms of that time frame that it takes to fully come to acknowledge one's sexuality, it can take a year, it can take two, it can take 30.
Yeah, as we've seen in some of the people in the book. I think it's such an interesting book to come out at this particular time in history where we are much further ahead in terms of gay rights than we were even 10 years ago, but there's still a lot of discrimination, oppression, and dishonesty. And some of the people in the... There's one writer in the book who said, I was just waiting for everybody to reject me, and nobody did. And she was happy. And there was another person who said, I couldn't believe how people whom I trusted and thought were my friends no longer called me anymore, and some people were really out and out ostracized. So we still have kind of the whole range of things going on in one country.
Yeah, there's a little more of a surprise when it does come to people who are totally accepting. And there's also a surprise. I mean, I think several of the women in the book said that people, like maybe a parent or a best friend, in the moment of hearing the coming out declaration were extremely accepting and great. But then, you know, 2 weeks later, they turned on them and attacked them for, and asked them, well, you know, maybe you just haven't met the right man. Maybe you're just traumatized from Uncle Joe. And it's almost worse to think that people that you really care about are supportive and with you. It's kind of worse for them to pretend that they are down, or that, you know, maybe they are in shock, and then to have them withdraw that once they've given it. It's kind of a really harsh wound.
One of the things that I think is also important is that when there are women who have found within their marriages that they're unhappy, and then figured out that they really, really prefer to be with a woman, it can turn their whole world upside down, and they end up questioning all sorts of conventions, not just the convention of marriage and family, but all the things that they were taught to believe. And whether it's comfortable and fun or not, they end up being more open-minded people, I think.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting notion, the idea that women may have a greater propensity for adaptability. Sexual fluidity, this notion that one's sexuality can change on you over a lifetime, is something that has been found in men, but is predominantly a woman phenomenon. So, there's all kinds of things that women have to struggle with in coming to terms with sexuality, which is such a profound part of one's identity. You know, it's you know, next to sex itself, you know, whether you're male or female, and of course we have lots of distinctions within that. You know, the various cultural and religious upbringings that the contributors in the book had are definitely forces that are to be contended with.
And, yeah.
You know, fortunately for me, I never had to deal with the shift that these women in the book had to go through. But Candace certainly had to deal with a number of problems.
Well, I think, I mean, I'm a prime example of not only an editor, but a contributor to the book who came from a very religious background. We also have somebody who was brought up Mormon, and various other variations on that. And you do, as a person, I mean, I know personally that I, as a little kid, my instinct was to identify, you know, to think about romantically about just relationships. When I was in kindergarten, I wanted to marry my best friend Stacy. You know, I told my parents, and they were completely horrified. That became a shift for me, you know, to seek out approval, to seek out being aligned with the people who would aid in my survival. And so I kind of internalized the views that heterosexuality was the way to go, everything else was a sin. And, you know, like many other people in the book and in the world, and as I went to college, realized that people I knew were gay and they were really great, I could open up about accepting them, and it triggered something in me to accept myself. So I think what you're saying is totally right on.
The example that you just gave about wanting to marry your best friend is a great example of how human sexuality is partly inherent and then partly learned and reinforced.
Yes.
So if you don't get that reinforcement, you can become 20, 30, 40, as some of the women in this book, and not know that you were gay. But there are very few people who reach 17 and don't know that they're heterosexual.
Right. It's just assumed.
This isn't so much what the book is about, but I think it's worth mentioning that sexual fluidity also goes the other way. I've known, probably you both have known, people, women who were in the super militant dyke mode in college and then married some dude at the age of 28 and had two kids and did
yes.
Suburbia. I've always wanted to know what happens to them later in life.
Ooh, that would be a good topic for study.
be a good topic for the next anthology. No, it's true. Lisa Diamond did find not only that women became more, you know, moved from being straight to gay or bi or questioning or unlabeled. They also went from totally identifying as gay to being heterosexually, you know, having a heterosexual relationship or considering that they were bi or just eschewing labels. So that is an important point because it's not just about women leaving men for women.
Yeah, I think one of the gifts of the term sexual fluidity, I mean, as a phrase, is that it opens up our language more to talk about these variations that people experience over the course of a lifetime. So that, you know, Candace sometimes uses this example that, you know, one could be gay in 1980 and then in 1990 find themselves living a straight life. Both things are true. Someone might switch back. It's one important distinction to make, though, is that it's not necessarily a choice. You know, it's a choice to... I mean, sexuality itself is not a choice. It is something that, again, might shift against people's will. You know, people don't choose to take on the status of a minority. You know, even though we've had some progress in gay rights, it's still a tremendous amount of risk-taking to live openly as a gay or lesbian or transgendered person.
Or bisexual person.
Or bisexual. You know, people can lose their jobs in a number of states. They can lose their homes. They can, you know, their children can be taken away from them. So the notion that sexuality is a choice is a dangerous one and a slippery slope to go down.
Well, it's I think, been shown to be quite absurd. And one of the things that this book does so beautifully is... it's really a lot of very nice, ordinary women talking about their life experiences. And when this spark of love comes into their life in one way or another, there's no choice in that at all. It's something that they either acknowledge or fight with. But they can't say, I choose not to do that, as if it were a, you know, I choose to buy this product instead of that.
Yeah, it's, you know, this book is about love. And it can be... I mean, obviously, people who are in heterosexual relationships and one of them goes for somebody of the opposite sex can act like, you know, a complete lunatic in terms of, you know, looking up the person on Google and driving past the house and writing love poems in their journal and, you know, walking away from what they pledged commitment to just because they're not there anymore. Like, they're not really so much walking away as just catching up with themselves. And so that happens for men and women and people who begin to identify as gay or not. And one of the things I really noticed in the book and in my own life is just to talk to what we were just saying about lack of privilege is that I totally know what I'm missing in terms of what I gave up as having heterosexual privilege. Anything from wanting to hold Laura's hand, walking down the street and second-guessing myself, or whether, you know, the plumber comes over and I'm figuring out whether I should switch some pronouns, not come out to this random stranger who might be, like, completely homophobic and weird.
Yeah, it's just, even in Santa Fe, you're worried about that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, gosh, I mean, people are still comfortably biased against gay people, especially if they assume that everyone in the room is on the same team.
Right.
I mean, I'm pretty, like, I don't really try to feel like I'm underprivileged or, you know, oppressed, but it's uncomfortable when you're at a Halloween party and you overhear somebody telling a gay joke.
What, I mean, heterosexual privilege, which we could talk about all day, you know, you have to give that up when you're in a situation, Candace, like you. What is gained?
Just the most beautiful plugging into, like, the personal power that comes with living your truth. It's just ecstatic. I felt cut off from my own sources of energy for my entire life, and suddenly I got a hit of what it felt like to actually be living in alignment with my own soul. And that was, I think, more intoxicating and more of a catalyst than even the person who I had a crush on at the time. I mean, I didn't want to hear at the time that that person was a catalyst. I didn't want to hear that at all. But she was. And that's okay.
I think taken as a whole, I was reading this book and I was thinking that although it's not something you talk about in daily life, it's not something you talk about in public, the depth and power of each person's sexuality is so central to who they are, to how they move around in the world, ultimately to how society works. And to embrace that and to explore it is just very important and can be messy.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I was, I don't know if I read it or heard it fairly recently, but it's something that I've always known and understood just living my own life, is that straight people don't have to come out every time they meet with a plumber or meet with a lawyer or go to the doctor or see an x-ray technician or, you know, move to a new street and introduce oneself to the neighbors. And, you know, because there is this assumed heterosexuality until you announce that you're different. And obviously the women in this book had to not only deal with that, but deal with, you know, the breakup of their previous relationship and redefining themselves along those lines. I mean, earlier I said something about Amelia Souter's quote about how she was gay and now she's straight. Others aren't so sure. You know, the others in the book are, you know, I still don't know. You know, do I call myself bisexual? That kind of overstates my relationship to men.
Yeah, there's a lot of women who just decide not to label themselves. And I do think that even in Lisa Diamond's book, Sexual Fluidity, she says a lot of women who decide not to call themselves bisexual do so because they feel that it overstates their relationship to men.
Right.
That it's not 50-50.
Well, and a lot of people who are bisexual aren't 50-50. And what's interesting is when we talk about choice, the rare people who really, truly are 50-50, and I know people who fit, women, I don't know any men, but I know a few women who fit into that category. They truly could go either way. Even then, it's not a choice.
Right.
The next person they meet, they can't decide, I don't think, I'm going to fall in love with a woman or I'm going to fall in love with a man. They fall in love with the person who comes along, and it's
right.
Often a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But there was one story in this by a woman who's probably in her 70s now, who, looking back, could see the patterns that showed that she probably would have been, you know, been gay and been with women had that been socially accepted. But at a certain, she married a man, she had children, and then later she fell in love with a woman, but she ended up marrying a second man and realized that on some level it was dishonest of her to stay in that relationship, but it was equally untrue to herself to break her commitments.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's such a generational difference between women of the... For her to fully be herself didn't mean to come out as a lesbian. It meant to keep her commitment to her husband.
Right. I definitely respect that. Personally, I, you know, my relationship with my ex-husband was over, and it sort of gave, you know, then I had the opportunity to go and run with this same-sex exploring thing. But many of the women in the book were happily married or expected to be married to their husbands for the rest of their lives, and then they met this woman. And
that's when it gets tricky.
Yeah, and I think maybe Sheila Smith, the older woman in the book who felt like it would be true to herself to honor her commitment, I believe that, you know, she's telling her truth. And I also think that it's easier to honor your commitment when it's way harder to do something else. And I think that a lot of the women in this book felt the breathing room to move into their own space without feeling like they were massively betraying their relationship.
Yeah, Sheila Smith does talk about how, you know, when she was growing up, you know, homosexuality was against the law.
Right.
And certain kinds of behavior would get you thrown in jail. And so when Candace says, you know, it was way harder for someone of her generation to come out or to explore her sexuality in that way, than to stick with a marriage that, you know, may have been working, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know.
And where the guy was her best friend and
absolutely,
that kind of thing.
Yeah. And there are so many women in the book whose ex-husbands are still a best friend, you know, where they've gone through a difficult period but have remained close to their husbands or their ex-husbands. You know, they have children together in some cases, and, you know, ultimately they have found, I think Lisa Diamond mentions this in the preface where she talks about how men are clearly not the villains here. And
I know you feel bad for a few of the guys in the book, I have to say.
There's a notable cast of characters of the men in this book who are wonderfully supportive and yet dealing with this, you know, terrible heartbreak. And so I'm glad that the book has that aspect, because the subtitle of the book, Women Write About Leaving Men for Women, sounds in some cases a little rough-edged than, you know, certainly not that we intended it to be that way. This isn't about women, like, sort of, you know, waking up with John one day and then the next day moving out and dumping him for Jane. it's really about a much longer shift that occurs over a lifetime.
It's a very thoughtful transition for these women.
And, you know, it's a continuity from, Candace, your last book, Ask Me About My Divorce, which was about women moving on in other ways.
Yeah, that book was about women deciding not to have the big D divorce become this shadow that fell over the rest of their lives, but instead something that would mark the end of one era and begin the end of another era.
The book is called Dear John, I Love Jane, Women Write About Leaving Men for Women, and co-editors Candace Walsh and Laura Andre will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Thursday, the 9th of December at 6 o'clock. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much. I also wanted to mention that Rouge Cat, the bar downtown near Collected Works, is offering free admission to anybody who comes to the reading, and there will be a related drink special.
Excellent.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm happy now to welcome James McGrath Morris. He is an author. He's been on this program before. His latest book is called Pulitzer, A Life in Politics, Print, and Power. But we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about the alternative gift market, which is coming up this Saturday, the 11th of December from 9 to 5, right in time for Christmas.
That's right. That's the idea. This is something that's been done a lot since the 1980s, particularly based by this group in Kansas called Alternative Gifts International. We've had some of these gift markets even here in Santa Fe, but they've usually been in church basements. And in a sense, we're trying to bring it out from underneath the church basement, and we're putting it into a very public area.
The convention center.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so we have a room set up right next door to the Contemporary Hispanic Art Market this weekend. The mayor is coming at 10 to cut the ribbon. And there'll be food, there are door prizes, books signed by a lot of local authors. Obviously, I know authors, so I was able to lure them into doing this. But the idea is that we're suggesting people, and particularly in this time of economic difficulty, that they add a gift to their shopping this year. By coming to the alternative gift market is a way to help others in need. Because we really don't sell an object. What we're doing is we're selling donations to 40 different projects around, primarily in the third world, although some are here in the United States. So a person would come in, they would enjoy a treat, cookies baked by the famous cook Deborah Madison.
Yay.
And other things like that, and some coffee from Java Joe's and other places. And they would be able to choose a gift to give. I mean, these range from things like mosquito netting for people warding off malaria, building a bicycle ambulance in places like Tanzania, even something that relates to radio. For instance, there's a project in Iraq and in Peru called Voices of Justice Radio that particularly works with refugee women. And for $33, you can provide a day of training for these women in broadcasting.
Sign me up.
So there's just a wonderful array of these kinds of things. So after you make your selection, you come over to a computer. We will make the donation using one of your major credit cards. And then you can get a gift card and send it to your friend. So I would send something to you, Mary Charlotte, saying, in honor of you, this year I have made a donation to allow women to have one day of training in the Voices of Justice radio broadcasting program in Iraq. So it's a way of expanding gift giving, and it's also a way to sort of retrain us. You know, come these holidays and birthdays, we're always out buying objects for people. And there's nothing wrong with that, per se, but at the same time, now that we've become so wealthy in industrial countries, this is another way to give gifts to people who have a lot and reward those who don't.
There's something about when you go to somebody's house or they come over to your house for Christmas and Christmas Eve, you want to have a little something for them. But I was thinking, you know, you could give a close friend or relative something that among these alternative gifts that they identify with, like for me with radio or for
certainly
somebody else.
That's
with,
why I picked that,
yeah,
exactly.
Right. And then make some beautiful cookies and give it to them on Christmas Eve, or something that is essentially consumable and it's not some piece of stuff that they then have to go home mm-hmm. and display on their shelf for the rest of their life and don't wish they wouldn't have to look at it.
Yeah, it's particularly true. I mean, I found that the older I've gotten, the less I need in the way of material things, that I really enjoy these kinds of things.
Yeah.
And my wife and my family and I for years have spent a long time before Christmas picking out and doing that kind of matching. I remember many years ago I gave to somebody who has everything in the world and wouldn't need anything. I gave a trombone to a disadvantaged group of kids in the Philippines who are starting a band. I noticed, for instance, I could give a bag of cement to build a rescue center in Kenya. And I have people who work with, you know, people in shelters here in the U.S., and I obviously support their causes. But what a great gift that connects the importance of their work to something like that, as opposed to yet one more object that they might not need in their house. So you're right. The matching is as much fun. The giving, in this sense, is as much fun as the receiving.
Now, does the recipient have any way to follow up with whatever group it is?
There is. The reason we work with Alternative Gifts International, which has been in business since 1986, is that they have a very rigorous process of selecting the 41 different projects they give to. They not only, these groups have to apply, it's similar to the folk art market in that they get vetted in applying, but they also follow up on the use of the money to make sure it actually went to it. I mean, you may give $15 for a large bag of cement. It's in a sense, they'll find out whether or not that money was spent for that purpose by the end of the year. 10% of the money goes to administer this whole project, and it is expensive. I mean, there's a staff in Kansas, there's a catalog. My work is voluntary. Everybody who's there is voluntary, but some is retained, and it's very clear. We explain that. Otherwise,
but 90%, that's a pretty good ratio.
Oh, it's a very good ratio, particularly since what we're doing is, if you think of it this way, the 10% that it costs is expanding the donor pool. We're reaching people who might not otherwise give. So in another way, it's bringing new money into these channels of getting money to the third world, as opposed to, you know, we might criticize the Red Cross if they spend too much of their money on administration. This is a different kind of project.
The Alternative Gift Market is this Saturday, the 11th of December from 9 to 5 at the Santa Fe Convention Center Coronado Room. And James McGrath Morris is an author, and he's working with the Alternative Gift Market. If for any reason people can't make it, is there a website
that
they can
go to? Yeah, this is what's so wonderful about this. Even if they don't make it, they can do this virtually.
Yeah.
Alternative Gifts International has its own website, and if you just Google Alternative Gifts International, you go right to it, and it's as easy as doing it from home. The only thing is, you'll miss out on the cookies.
Ah, the cookies. Okay, well, we will see you in Cookiedom on Saturday. James, thanks for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.